Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Twitter is making money, and Twitter is losing money. Kodak gets by with a little help from its friends, and when Harry met eHarmony? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, the 30th of July, and it's great to have you with us. Some 8 million Americans work for franchises, and many of them could be affected by a decision the National Labor Relations Board's General Counsel has handed down. If the owner of a McDonald's fast food franchise violates labor laws, the McDonald's Corporation could be held jointly liable for the franchisee's bad behavior. Marketplace's Noelle King has the story.
For now, the decision by the NLRB's general counsel affects only the McDonald's Corporation and McDonald's franchises. There are 3,000 other brands with franchise operations in the U.S., employing 8.5 million people, says Matthew Haller of the International Franchise Association.
Dry cleaners, gyms, flower shops, print centers, realtors. They really run through the fabric of the American economy.
Haller says the decision could destroy the franchise industry. Franchises may bear the name of big companies, he says, but they are owned and run as small businesses.
They set the wages, they hire and fire their employees, determine the appropriate benefits for their employees, and are responsible for all the decisions that take place at the employee level.
But the NLRB said the McDonald's Corporation exercises enough control over how franchises are run to make it a co-employer of the people who work for franchises. Wilma Liebman is a former chair of the NLRB. She's been advising the SEIU, a union that is working to organize fast food workers, on these cases.
They do exercise quite a bit of control over their franchisees in order to protect their brand. And that includes substantial control over the way the services are performed, the work is done.
What McDonald's Corp controls and what it doesn't is laid out in the terms of its franchise agreement, which is why even though other franchisees in lots of other industries are watching the decision closely, it's not yet clear how it will affect any other company. McDonald's said in a statement that it plans to contest the NLRB's decision. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Twitter released its quarterly results yesterday, and they were impressive. Investors were pleased. Shares of Twitter stock jumped almost 20% today. Here's a rundown of the good news. The social media giant picked up 16 million users in the last few months. There are now 267 million tweeters in the Twitterverse. And revenue more than doubled thanks to new types of mobile ads. Of course, revenue and profit are not the same thing. Twitter is still losing money. The company lost $144 million last quarter. So what'll it take for the company to turn a profit? How much does that really matter? Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith.
The business strategy of many tech companies bears a strong resemblance to the business model of some characters from South Park. The Underpants Gnomes. They are, well, gnomes who steal people's underpants as part of a business strategy.
You see, phase one, collect underpants. Phase two, phase three, profit.
Oh, I get it.
It's actually a very good business model.
That's Eric Yoakumstaller, CEO of Vivaldi Partners. And he's actually not talking about the underpants gnomes. He's talking about Twitter and other tech companies. They attract millions of users with free services, phase one. They try to figure out some way to exploit those users, phase two, in order to make millions of dollars, phase three. Yoakumstaller says we've seen this work time and again. Think Google and Facebook.
As habit forms and as the millions of people become hooked, Twitter has an opportunity to add advertising, basically monetizing the asset.
But that could be tricky for Twitter, says Ken Wilber, a professor of marketing at UC San Diego. He says advertisers love Facebook because it knows so much about its users, and there are so many of them. They don't love Twitter quite as much.
When you put ads into the Twitter feed itself, it lowers the utility of Twitter to its users, and they don't have a great platform for putting ads next to the feed.
Wilber says it remains to be seen whether Twitter can find a way to fully monetize its users. He says it could be the next Facebook or the next Friendster. At one time, Friendster was the biggest social network on the web with more than 100 million users. And now, it's a gaming site based in Malaysia. Ah, the pitfalls of phase two. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The Fed wrapped up its two-day meeting today and said, quote, there remains significant underutilization of labor resources. Translation, they are still worried about jobs. Fed also said it's not going to raise interest rates. On Wall Street today, the markets were mixed. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The largest Ebola outbreak in history has already killed more than 670 people in West Africa. Health officials around the globe fear the deadly virus will spread. The Peace Corps today announced it's removing volunteers from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Companies that do business in Africa are also worried. They're wondering how to respond. The BBC's West Africa correspondent is Thomas Fessy, and we've got him on the line from his home base in Senegal's capital, Dakar. Hi, Thomas.
Hello.
So you're there in Dakar, Senegal. This virus has not yet been found in Senegal. Are people talking about it? Are they worried about it?
People are definitely talking about the spread of the Ebola virus. The government here, when the outbreak started a few months ago, closed the land border with Guinea. And so people have families that are related across the border. Some are from the same ethnic groups. So obviously, the ties are very strong. And the cross-border trade or activities are a very important element of the daily life of the local population.
And recognizing, of course, that the humanitarian costs of this are paramount. Have you heard from foreign companies based abroad, about what they're thinking as this virus continues to spread there in West Africa?
Well, this is an economy that now it is heavily relying on imports, and other countries do have mining resources, and this is where the worry is. For example, just 10 days ago, the Medical and Travel Security Group, International SOS, said that it had received hundreds of requests for advice on the outbreak. It said that requests went up 400% in June. We have mining companies like London Mining, for example, or African Minerals that have imposed travel restrictions on their workers and have withdrawn their non-essential staff from the region. So clearly, foreign companies want to know whether it is a risk for them to continue producing here or not. But observers are saying that for now, the Ebola outbreak has had little or no economic impact so far.
Obviously, there's a lot of concern that this virus could spread if someone were to go from one place to another via airplane. And I wonder what things are like there at the airport in Dakar.
Well, the worry is here, but I have to say that I haven't seen any health checks or anything like this in at the Dakar airport.
Nothing.
Nothing yet. I think that the problem is a lot bigger in airports in Conakry, the capital in Guinea, or in Liberia, for example, in Monrovia there. Although all the medical kits have been flown in and distributed to all the health centers throughout the country, including some at the airport, I don't think that there are any health checks here for now.
Thomas Fessy is the BBC's correspondent in West Africa. Thank you very much for your time today.
No worries. Thank you.
There's good chance many of the electronics you own were made by Foxconn. That includes your iPhone and your iPad, if you have one. Foxconn employs hundreds of thousands of workers, mostly in China. But the company's had trouble with attrition. Turnover has always been a big problem. But as Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports, Foxconn is trying to change that.
There are a lot of lines at a typical Foxconn factory in China. There's the assembly line. Thousands of young people, typically high school dropouts, put together each and every part of an iPad. It's tedious, mind-numbing work, and that's why assembly line workers typically don't stick around very long. They quit, and that necessitates another line. The hiring line outside a Foxconn factory in China stands at attention, receiving orders from an HR manager. Hundreds of migrants from the countryside arrive each day to replace workers who've quit. When you consider the manufacturer has a million workers, it's China's largest private employer, this labor cycle isn't surprising. But it is costly, Foxconn manager Li Yongzhong.
The turnover rate is pretty high, and it's impossible to retain all our workers. But we'd like every employee to be able to develop and improve their knowledge, skills, and income so that they'll want to stay here.
That's the rationale behind what the company calls Foxconn University. It's a company-wide accredited university system. After workers finish their shift on the assembly line, they can take classes towards a high school diploma, a bachelor's, a master's, even a PhD. A professor teaches a computer animation class to students at Foxconn's plant in Chengdu, a factory devoted to making iPads. Instead of making Apple products, each one of these Foxconn workers is using an Apple computer to follow the professor's instructions. 36-year-old Ai Guo sits in front of the class.
I dropped out of school when I was 16. My family was very poor, and they needed me to help out on the farm.
This is a typical story among the hundreds of millions of young rural Chinese who tend to leave school to farm or find work at factories like Foxconn. Ai Guo hopes to spend the next 6 years studying towards the equivalent of a high school diploma and then a bachelor's degree in industrial engineering.
With that, I'd like to get a promotion to start working on industrial automation and, of course, raise my salary.
Foxconn's university system offers 25 majors, most of them in engineering. More than 50 Chinese universities send professors to teach courses at the factories. But it's not just Foxconn. In-house university systems are becoming a trend among China's state-owned companies, says Richard Brubaker, professor at Siebes University. Brubaker says Foxconn's university shows the company sees its line workers as more than machines with five-year shelf lives.
And much like a UPS driver becomes the CEO, they could actually be the future management executives of the company that know the company so intimately that they're the ones who are able to look at risk, look at decisions very differently than an outsider would.
The development of an in-house university system comes at a pivotal moment for Foxconn. CEO Terry Goh is 63, and he's thinking about his legacy. He's moving the company away from making products for everyone else in favor of developing Foxconn's own products. Foxconn's Li Yongzhong.
We want our employees to become more innovative and creative, more entrepreneurial.
But so far, participation in Foxconn University is low, just 3% of its 1 million Chinese workers. Li assures me that will change. Someday, every employee will study at Foxconn University. We will no longer call them workers, he says. We'll call them students. In Chengdu, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up, why you don't see too many rom-coms at the box office these days.
You know, movies in the sort of Judd Apatow, you know, range that are wacky and fun and very entertaining, but they don't really talk about, you know, the world of Tinder and eHarmony and Match.com and all of that.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 31 points, 0.2% to settle at 16,880. The NASDAQ bumped up 20 points, 0.5% to close at 4,462. And the S&P 500 rose less than a point to finish at 1970. We talked about Twitter earlier, but I'll use 47 characters to say this again. The social media giant rose 20% today. Morgan Stanley pocketed a 2% gain. Bank of America climbed up more than 1%. Even though there was news a federal judge ordered the bank to pay $1.25 billion for defective mortgages sold by Countrywide Financial. Japan's Nikkei index gained 0.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.55%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on financial products for students. LinkedIn is scheduled to report quarterly earnings. And on July 31st, 1790, the first U.S. patent was issued to Samuel Hopkins. He developed a process of making potash, an ingredient used in fertilizer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. In a divorce, the battles over money can seem endless, but eventually the financial crisis ends, right? Maybe not. As Julia Picard reports from Portland, Oregon, the end of a divorce, for older women especially, is often just the beginning.
If you are mystified by the financial process, work with a financial advisor.
We're at a divorce workshop called Second Saturday. Women of all ages are packed around a large conference table. One of them is Jenny Juffs. She's divorcing after 19 years of marriage. She also has two special needs children. Like many women, Juffs is pretty shocked by her new financial reality.
I've been a wife or a homemaker all my life, so everything's changing me. I've never managed money.
The situation is particularly grim for older women. Today, a quarter of divorced women over 60 live in poverty. And overall, older women see their household income drop by 41%. That's twice the amount of their ex-husband. And to make matters worse, baby boomers are splitting up at record rates.
So we're seeing these 20, 25, 30, 35-year marriages coming apart with the women that have never worked outside the home.
Grace Antares is a financial advisor. She also heads Portland's local chapter of Second Saturday. Many people who come to her divorce seminar are completely inexperienced when it comes to financial planning. She often sees their panic, like one middle-aged woman who fled the room.
She explained to one of my colleagues that she was going through what felt like PTSD to her, that she had been separated from her husband for 10 years and had made every single mistake, you know, that we had mentioned in the course of the first part of the class.
So financial literacy is important, but Antara says the biggest contributor to post-divorce success is earning power. Yet many women who spend more time focusing on the family often lack job skills. Just ask Jenny Juffs.
And I'm also trying to just build basic skills like a keyboarding class. And so I know how to use the computer a little bit, but not Office or Excel or anything that everybody's going to need.
Antara says even women who have good jobs can make poor financial decisions after divorce. And the closer to retirement these mistakes are made, the more devastating the effect. Grace Antara, now 64 years old, has her own story.
I was highly emotionally attached to the house. Pulled out all the equity to pay him. I was the bigger earner, pay him a big settlement. And then when the real estate market crashed, house was underwater instantly. Mm-hmm. And so he got all the tax-free cash, and I got a foreclosure and a bankruptcy.
Antares' own experience is what helps fuel the one message she repeats all the time.
You're going to be in charge of your finances for the rest of your life.
Because the divorce rate after second marriages is even higher. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Julia Picard for Marketplace.
Times have been tough for the Eastman Kodak Company. It filed for bankruptcy, there were layoffs and more layoffs. It's trying hard to survive. Well, Kodak may get some help from a few friends in Hollywood. Directors like Christopher Nolan and Quentin Tarantino are pushing movie studios to commit to buying a certain amount of film from Kodak for the next several years. So say that happens, then what? Tracy Samuelson reports.
Even though the movie industry has gone digital, these directors want to preserve the option to shoot film in the future. Dave Riebstein, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, says having that option will actually depend on what Kodak does with these sales.
If you're just getting more money to continue to do what it is that you were doing that wasn't working, that's not going to be a successful strategy.
He says when GM invested in saving its tired but iconic Cadillac brand, it succeeded with a major redesign and targeting different customers. But propping up a company in the short term can be like a finger in the dike, says Ken Doctor, a media analyst for Newsonomics, like when former French President Nicolas Sarkozy wanted to help ailing newspapers.
He had the government fund one-year subscriptions to, I believe, the students graduating from high school as a way to stem the tide. That was a short-lived program.
But there is still value in Kodak's brand now that it has an artisanal quality to it, says Douglas Holt, the president of the Cultural Strategy Group, a brand consultancy. He says Kodak used to be a symbol of mass culture. Now it's antiquated and cool.
Pabst Blue Ribbon, Polaroid, you know, a lot of these brands that were mass culture brands of the older, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s have the same, you know, possibility to push back against the mass culture of today.
But the problem for Kodak, says Holt, is that a lot more of these once iconic companies fail than succeed. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Maybe you've seen this movie. Meg Ryan, playing a woman who's uptight and afraid of flying, gets on a plane, flies to France to win back her fiancé, and ends up falling in love with her seatmate, a French jewel thief played by a mustachioed Kevin Kline. Well, I watched that romantic comedy, French Kiss, by the way, just a couple of weeks ago, and it is so evidently a movie of the mid-1990s. Since then, romantic comedies have been on the decline, and according to Megan Garber with The Atlantic, that's because times have changed, but the rom-com hasn't. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
So let's set this up first. You've got some problems with the genre of romantic comedies.
I do. I mean, I do love the genre in general, but I do think, you know, for a very long time, people have been sort of proclaiming the death of the romantic comedy. And I think right now, those are actually fairly valid because romantic comedies have not really caught up with the reality of dating for a lot of people right now.
We used to watch these movies to get a sense of what could be, and there's less of a reason to do that now.
I think so, exactly. I mean, they've always sort of modeled behavior for us in some ways and sort of told us, you know, this is how people who are dating, people who are romantically involved interact with each other. And there's always been a little bit of a coding element to that. And, you know, we have movies like Love Actually and, you know, movies in the sort of Judd Apatow, you know, range that are wacky and fun and very entertaining, but they don't really talk about, you know, the world of Tinder and eHarmony and Match.com and all of that is not really well reflected in Hollywood. At this point,
yeah, you're all but giving advice to screenwriters here saying, get your act together. There's an opportunity here to make movies like the ones you just described. Yet that's not happening. I mean, there's a cultural thing happening here. People aren't watching these movies as much as maybe they did in the past. But there's also a commercial one, and that is studios aren't making romantic comedies the way that they were.
That's right. Exactly. There is this emphasis now on movies that will do well, not just in the United States, but globally. And so, you know, the movies that tend to do well in that context are the, you know, the robots and the aliens and the movies with a lot of explosions and all of that, because there is something sort of culturally transcendent about those movies. And, you know, there is something to be said about rom-coms that are, you know, they come from a very sort of American-centric point of view often and adopt American social codes and mores as the normal. So there is something to be said, actually, for the fact that there is something good about the death of the rom-com in that perspective.
Just looking back at all the romantic comedies that have been made, you know, the economy was in much better shape back then. I think if you've got mail, there were actual bookstores that were open that people were going to. Of course, that was the subject of that film as well, sort of the encroachment of the internet. But to what extent were these films sort of propelled by the booming economy of the mid to late 90s?
I think they were to a large extent. When you have a booming economy, it sort of frees you up to focus on non-economic concerns. And one of those concerns often is love and romance and relationships. There's probably some phenomenon where if there is a good economy, people, you know, want to sort of think about what options would be available to them, you know, now that they have their sort of economic security.
What does a romantic comedy in 2014 need to have to be successful, do you think? If a studio executive were to break the mold and throw a few million at making a romantic comedy, what would it look like, you know, in this day and age?
What I would love to see is something that really does account for the way that so many people are dating now, which is through the internet and through, you know, meeting people online and relying to some extent on algorithms to connect them. So I would love to see a movie that would account for that in some way, kind of an updated version of You Got Mail, which really did try to account for the new realities that the internet was creating in a way now that seems very sort of quaint. But I would love to see something like that for those digital connections that are made before the physical connection is there.
The misleading profile and all of that.
That would be great. I would love to see that movie.
Megan Garber is a staff writer at The Atlantic. You can find a link to her piece, When Harry Met eHarmony, at marketplace.org. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, the Motion Picture Association of America is a big fan of drones, unmanned aerial systems officially. The organization sent a letter to the Federal Aviation Administration yesterday asking the agency to make it easier for directors to use drones for filming. Well, another big fan of drones, Martha Stewart. She has written a piece for Time called Why I Love My Drone. And I'm not sure why that headline went out over my drone. It's a good thing. I know there's someone who got that joke. Anyway, someone gave her one last summer as a gift, and we learn her mind started racing as she imagined all the different applications for it. Martha and her staff have been taking pictures of her beach house in Maine, her farm in New York. An aerial shot of the vegetable garden, she writes, looked very much like my Peter Rabbit marzipan embellished Easter cake. Aha. Uh-huh. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dipped 31 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq bumped up 20 points, 0.5%. And the S&P 500 rose less than a point. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.